told John that I wanted to take a look around outside the fence, as on one side it seemed to be clear of trees and shrubs. Once again, using the blanket technique, I climbed over the fence, with a fully recovered John in tow. John left the .22 with William and the girls, and he took the shotgun, because the shotgun wouldn't be a good idea to use through the fence. The fenced area we came from was about 10 feet lower than the hill we were climbing to the clearing. As we topped the small hill, an expansive view unfolded in front of us. There was enough flatland here to land and take off with a small plane, and a fence similar to the other was about 300 meters ahead. As we neared this second fenced-in area, we noticed that it was much larger than the one we had spent the night in, and it harbored a small, shed-sized brick building with a gray painted steel door and a series of antennas on the roof. When we made it to the fence, John and I noticed a helicopter landing pad inside the perimeter. Also, there was a large patch of blackened grass surrounding what looked like a very large square hole in the ground. No sign of movement anywhere. We had a clear range view in all directions. We could even barely make out the tops of the razor wire fence where William and the others were waiting. This was definitely not a base, but it was something. John and I went back for the blankets so that we could scale this new fence. We told William of our discovery and returned to the new area. Before scaling the fence, I checked the gate just in case. It was locked solid with some sort of cipher locking device. The other area had a large chain and cut-resistant padlock on it. I had a feeling that this area was a little more important than the other. We jumped the fence and began checking the perimeter. I walked toward the helicopter pad, keeping my eyes open for any sort of movement. The hole in the ground piqued my curiosity further, so John and I decided to check it out. As we edged toward the chasm, I started realizing what this place was. I had never seen one in real life, but this area might as well have a Minuteman III sign posted on the fence. I was standing where a strategic missile had recently launched. The ground was blackened around the gaping horizontal launch doors. I grabbed my flashlight from my pack and checked around the rim of the opening for some sort of access ladder. There was one about 3 feet below the lip of the thick steel doors that were retracted back sideways into the ground. John held my arm as I hung my leg over into the darkness of the vertical launch shaft. My weapon was slung over my shoulder as I started my descent down into the darkness. The shaft seemed at least 60 feet deep, as it took forever to descend. When I looked up, John seemed a million miles away. I didn't know if I was going crazy at the time, but I could swear I could hear the faint sound of music. I stood at the bottom of the shaft. Shining my light around, I could see dead squirrels that had fallen down the shaft and died from lack of food and water. Dirt and leaves also lined the floor. These doors have been open for a while. Some of the dead squirrels were all but rotted to the bone. I checked the bottom level of the shaft. I noticed an oval-shaped door with a wheel in the center on the opposite end from where I was standing. I asked John if he could get down without my help. He didn't answer, but I could see his leg catch the first rung of the ladder as he began his climb down. As John was on his way down, I grabbed the wheel and moved it counterclockwise, lefty-loosey, to see if it would budge. To my surprise, it did. I suppose the 3 feet thick blast doors at the top of the shaft were good enough to keep intruders out, so they didn't bother locking the insignificant 4-inch thick oval hatch at the bottom. But why didn't they close the blast doors after launch? John was now down with me. He stood behind me as I finished turning the wheel crank to unlock the access hatch. I turned it all the way left and heard the sound of a metal clank as the bolts simultaneously released from the frame. I pulled the door outward and the hiss of air rushed in or out, I couldn't tell. I opened the door fully. Bright light and the sound of music blasted out at John and I. "It's the end of the world as we know it," R.E.M. I guess the end of the world breeds cynicism. Pulling my weapon up to my chest, John and I made our way into the interior of this modern-day castle. I had no idea of the layout of the place. I took the lead as we headed toward the source of the music. All the interior lights were on, and we were walking slowly. The song ended. Then it began playing again. It was in a constant loop. I had hoped different, because the music gave me a false sense of life. For all I knew, the song could have been looping for months, now that I had heard it loop once. We were closer to the music. It was blaring. Wire in a fire represent the seven games in a government for hire and a combat site. Rounding the corner to where we thought the music was coming from, we came to an open door that I estimated to be a foot thick. It looked like a bank vault door. The music was coming from inside that room. I could see computer panel lights flashing intermittently inside, and the smell of rot was pungent in the air. I gave John the look, and I stepped in. Captain Baker was the first corpse to meet my gaze. Tied up in a steel chair was an Air Force captain with the name tag Baker pinned above his right pocket. He writhed and struggled with the bonds that held him firm. His skin was being torn off in places by the ropes. Another officer lay slumped over a command console with a Beretta 9mm in one hand and half his head missing. I can only theorize to what happened. Baker had 3 gunshot wounds to the chest and a cracked skull. As the creature sat there, writhing, I grabbed the sidearm out of the other officer's stiff, rotting hand. Checking the magazine, I counted 11 rounds. 3 for Baker, and 1 for the no-name tag Major Tom, added to 15. I suppose Baker was infected. Major Tom tied him up, launched the missile, then shot Baker 3 times in the chest before taking his own life. Of course, it is all speculation and doesn't really matter at this point. 23:26 hours. John and I led the others to the silo, terminated Baker, and took him, along with Major Tom, to an empty room for temporary storage. Power, food, shelter, and water seemed to be in abundance. I have no way of knowing if the internet backbone is still operational. I am currently utilizing this compound's computer system. Most of the secure consoles are still logged in, and many of the non-secure desktop computers are working. Need to figure out a way to get those blast doors shut. We'll be looking for the keys to the kingdom in the following days. Hotel 23. April 1st, 09:12 hours. I searched the Baker and Major Tom corpses and found numerous personal items and a notepad. Of particular interest was Baker's notepad containing numerous passwords for the different systems in the facility, and a proximity card for entering certain doors. This facility is powered by the local power grid, along with 4 huge diesel generators. The local power has not gone out in this area. I have located some technical manuals in the desk drawers of the control room. They outline different emergency procedures and capacities for this facility. One of the manuals stated that if this facility is properly stocked, it would provide air, food, water, and shelter for 100 people for 180 days. One problem remains: figuring out how everything works and where everything is. We have not explored the entire facility for fear there may be more of the undead lurking in the catacombs of the outer-reaching compartments. One thing worthy of mention is that all the manuals have the words Hotel 23 printed on the covers. A ceremonial wood plaque hangs over the main control console with the same words carved into it in English and below that in Russian. The facility galley has a large pantry full of canned food and numerous items called sea rations. I have never eaten one, but I have heard about them from some of the old-timers I served with before all of this happened. There are also numerous cases of MREs lining the shelves in the back of the walk-in pantry. John, while working with the computer control system, figured out how to operate the remote cameras outside the facility. No luck on finding out how to shut the blast door. Found the main entrance and exit with John's security camera. Unfortunately, it is a quarter of a mile away down the access tunnel and up an elevator. Worse still, the fact that 100 undead can be seen on the closed-circuit television milling about outside the doors. April 2nd. 2007 hours. I have located a handwritten schematic of the facility today. Some of the rooms don't match the schematic. I assume because some areas may have been added to the facility since it was drawn. We plan to fully clear out the interior of the bunker by tomorrow. It stinks like rotten flesh and old fruit. April 4th, 1535 hours. While rummaging through the living area of the silo yesterday, I found Captain Baker's personal diary. It dates back 2 years to March. It pretty much outlines everything that happened here since the beginning. I have not read it in its entirety, however, I plan to do so in the coming days. Copied. Captain Baker, USAF. January 10th. I have been ordered to alert status here at Hotel 23. We keep receiving startling communique from Missile Command regarding our new coordinates for the alternate target packages. Although the coordinates are not in plain language, I have seen enough of them to know that the data we are inputting will not point the nukes overseas. We are confined to the silo on alert status until further notice. Luckily, I thought to bring almost a dozen books with me this time, unlike the last drill we were running. My superiors seem to feel that this epidemic may pose a real problem to our security. We made an attempt to thoroughly clean the interior today. From time to time, I can hear a mechanical electrical sound kick in from another area inside the bunker. I have a feeling it is some sort of air filtration system. We cleared most of the silo yesterday, all except the room marked Environmental Control. There is a heavy steel door with a cipher lock blocking access to the interior. The notepad taken from the officer a couple days ago had no useful codes for this particular door. John found a folder on the desktop of one of the launch control computers. The non-classified computers are using Windows. However, the secure tempest-resistant boxes are running some form of Linux that I have never seen. John has been using some sort of DOS-like non-GUI, graphical user interface, to explore the computer. He has been able to bring up numerous color aerial photographs of the same area, unknown. Only it seems like every time he accesses the folder with the photographs and selects the same file name, it shows a slightly different photo, i.e. different cloud placement, or some other minute detail. Also on the list to access is a large 7-foot-tall thick steel safe marked Armory. Unfortunately, there is a rather large padlock in place on the front of the safe, temporarily barring access. I haven't really gotten a chance to get to know Tara, but she did reveal just how curious of a person she really is. She did not like the idea of not being able to see what was in the safe, and searched the bunker for 3 hours, digging through boxes, trying to find something that would be useful in cutting the lock. No joy. On a side note, all of the toilets in this facility are similar to airplane latrines, dry bowls. I suppose it conserves water, which reminds me of the water supply here. We found a large rectangular tank in the diesel generator rooms marked potable water. Using the butt of my rifle, I tapped the side of it until a hollow sound resonated through the chamber. It was over 3/4 of the way full. The tank is roughly 20 feet by 10 feet by 5 feet. I will do calculations in the coming days as to how much water we can and should be using. A picture is worth 1,000 words. April 6th, 2144 hours. It should have been obvious the reason the photos that John was pulling up on the secure Unix computer were changing. They were near real-time satellite imagery. John figured out what it was last night, and also figured out how to zoom the photos down to what the computer indicates is 0.2-meter resolution. Using rough coordinates in the road atlas, we were able to see detailed photography of what was left of the San Antonio area. It was difficult at first to interpret the overhead angle of the photos. Also, the color wasn't tweaked very well, making the photos look a little off. After numerous command line inputs, John zoomed down to a 1,000-meter resolution, and we were able to see a good section of what was left of downtown. The photo was a few minutes old, according to the timestamp, due to the fact that the satellite was configured to automatically photograph a certain footprint at a certain time. John couldn't figure out how to get the bird to take a snapshot on demand. studying the photo, I could make out numerous destroyed buildings, and even some of those creatures that must have wandered back after the initial blast, attracted by the sound and light. I could also make out a group of them huddled around something. John zoomed in the best he could to the center of the group of corpses. The group was fighting over the carcass of a large rat. I suppose a picture really is worth a thousand words. John and I planned to go city by city, entering coordinates and attempting to gather any information we can on what cities were destroyed and which ones still stand. This will take some time, but worth the peace of mind, or lack thereof. Jan and William have settled into one of the larger compartments with Laura. John told them it would be fine by him if Annabelle slept with Laura at night. John knew the dog helped Laura deal with our situation, as Annabelle was something familiar from a world long fucked. Yesterday, Tara and I went topside to check the perimeter, as the camera near where we climbed in only covered the launch bay doors. Kind of ironic how John can figure out how to look at a dead man's wristwatch from 1,000 miles away with a satellite, but can't seem to figure out how to get our back door closed. I have to give him credit, as he has proven himself a good friend and a very adaptable person. April 8th, 23:24 hours. After a few days of figuring out coordinates with many failed attempts, we have come across cities on the satellite photos that are confirmed destroyed by either nukes or more conventional MOABs. I wanted to use the birds to see my home back in Arkansas, but they didn't seem to work above a certain longitude. San Antonio, New Orleans, San Diego, Los Angeles, Dallas, and Orlando, and probably New York, have been destroyed, and we have confirmed that dead walk the ruined streets. This is a definite blow to the group's morale, including my own. John and I, using a larger resolution in order to see a more wide view of the cities, saw mass devastation. Not even one of the photos displayed any living human. Some of the groups we were seeing reminded me of old photos of the Woodstock crowds. There was no way to count, but I estimate there are millions of undead in highly radiated areas of ruined cities. There is no telling how many walk in unaffected areas of the United States. We are hopelessly outnumbered, and worse, there seems to be no fragment of any government remaining. John and I attempted to gather satellite intelligence on the more northern states, but were unsuccessful due to the fact of the limitations of the satellite footprint, area of effective satellite view. However, I was able to find some information on the fate of New York City. Upon closer inspection of the command and control area, I found a black briefcase with a double spin lock set to the numbers 205 on both sides, wedged between two consoles. The case was unlocked, and inside was a printed message. I suppose the government used the Space and Missile Command to take up the slack for the rogue pilots. They must have foreseen this coming, as Baker commented on his new target packages well before the pilots decided to disobey orders. Message: Top secret from Space and Missile Command to Lone Star. Info to NORAD. Subject: Command launch. Authority: Magenta rocket. Authority for domestic release of tactical nuclear weapons has been authorized by the President of the United States. Authentication coding to follow. Flash transmission. Target package Biscuit, 870E57E86YF, confirmed. Location, New York City, New York. Original tactical weapons scheduled for NYC are Broken Arrow, pilots Rogue. End message. April 11th, 12:33 hours. Still no key to the small arms locker. I am debating on whether or not it is worth it to go out into an urban area to retrieve the necessary equipment needed to cut the lock off. A cutting torch would be optimal, but I doubt I would be able to procure one. It may have to be a hacksaw. Bolt cutters would be useless, as the lock bolt is so large no cutters I have seen would get through it. John found the access code needed to get into the environmental compartment. It was embedded in the file system in the facility control folders. As with any new area, we are very cautious about going in. John held the door and waited for me to give the signal. I dreaded shooting anything in this compartment, as I did not want the ricochet to damage any vital systems inside. John slung the door open. It was very dark. I pulled my NVGs down over my eyes and switched them on. Walking in, I saw no danger. The room was very clean. Finding the light switch on the wall, I plugged the goggles back up above my eyes and flipped the switch. It took a few seconds for the fluorescent bulbs to kick in. The room touted a huge air cleansing system, of which I have no idea how to adjust or maintain. There were equipment racks holding all sorts of environmental monitoring gadgets. Right off the bat, I noticed two different varieties of gas masks, and also five Geiger counter devices sitting side by side in a neat row. The gas masks were without filters, as the filters were still sealed in the tins sitting next to the masks. I counted 10 gas masks of both types, 20 in all. On the floor, there were several boxes that had CBR suit stamped on the side. Using my knife, I carefully cut away the tape and found that each box contained 10 olive drab chemical, biological, and radiological protective suits, sealed in plastic. Also in the box was a set of specifications and instructions on how long and how much exposure a human can expect to take while wearing the suits. It is clear that this facility was designed to endure a nuclear attack. I just don't understand why there were only two officers stationed here and no other VIP survivors. Maybe the world fell apart too quickly, or this outpost wasn't even on the map. That brings up another important item. It was only yesterday when I found out where we were. It seemed like a long time ago when we left the Bahama Mama and blindly ran into this place after what seemed like days of walking, taking turns carrying Laura and Annabelle. Using satellite imagery, John found our location. We estimated our general direction of travel from the shoreline and used the atlas to enter in coordinates. We first had to find the boat. We then adjusted our coordinates and resolution northwest in baby steps until we found the wreckage site where the fireman was hanging from the hydraulic ladder. After this, we kept walking the coordinates, painstakingly northwest again, until we came upon the facility. It was easily seen, as the gaping hole of the launch bay was an obvious flag. John marked the exact coordinates on a piece of paper. Just to make sure we were looking at the right photo, I took a roll of toilet paper up topside, made sure the area was clear, and made a giant letter X with the toilet paper near the open launch bay doors. After about 15 minutes of waiting, John re-entered the coordinates, and sure enough, the toilet paper X was immediately visible from the 100-meter resolution we had entered. Keeping the same coordinates, we zoomed out to 200 kilometers of resolution. Though we could not see our facility, we knew it was center screen, because that is how the program works. We were able to determine, using the atlas and the photo, that we were near the small town of Nada, Texas. The bad news was that we were also about 60 miles southwest of Houston. Houston was not destroyed in the nuclear campaign, and remembering the photos we pulled up on the 8th, we knew it was crawling with the undead. Using the CCT cameras, we can monitor undead movement at the main entrance. However, using the satellite photos, we can attempt to monitor the big picture now that we have our exact coordinates. Knock, knock. April 12th, 22:19 hours. I have not mentioned, documented, much about the entertainment value of the facility. There is a lounge area equipped with television, VCR, and DVD player. Numerous DVDs line the inside of the wood case the TV is sitting on. After opening the case and checking the contents, I came across one of my old favorites, Omega Man on VHS. For some reason, I just cannot bring myself to watch it. Sort of like watching a war movie while still on the battlefield. I have taken to running the perimeter fence during the day. I check the CCT monitor prior to going outside to make sure the crowd is still where I saw them last, hopelessly clawing at the thick steel door at the front of the facility. After almost 50 laps around the perimeter fence, I come in and take a very short shower. I usually time myself so that I can conserve water. This reminds me of boot camp and officer candidate school, where I had to put the shampoo in my hair before getting in the shower to save time in the shower. I have my time down to 1 minute. The others don't seem to have the discipline or the concept of conservation. I can't expect everyone to act like a machine, I suppose. Perhaps that is my problem lately. I have been so shell-shocked that I have reverted to logic and emotionless response to deal with the situation at hand. After checking the facility thoroughly a few days ago, we now have a suitable entrance to get in and out without having to climb the silo ladder every time. There were stairs that led up to where we thought was the shed-sized brick building with a gray-painted steel door. Since this access door led to the surface near the launch bay doors, we thought it best and safer to use it. Tara and I spent time together today. We are becoming friends. Under close supervision, she and I let Annabelle and Laura outside to play in the perimeter area. Yesterday afternoon, John and I went outside. Using some twine and 4 wooden stakes taken from the maintenance compartment, we made a makeshift fence around the launch bay door area. I didn't want any of us accidentally falling in. Obviously, we still have not figured out the coding needed to operate the bay doors. John seems to know how to access the right area of the computer system, but he just doesn't want to make a mistake and open the main doors in front of the complex. Opening Pandora's box would let hundreds of those demons inside, forcing us to quarantine a large part of the compound. After watching Laura play outside with Annabelle, I forgot about the undead for a while. It wasn't until half an hour later, when the wind brought the moans of the dead to my attention, did I remember the dire circumstances that brought us here to Hotel 23. I rushed them back into the facility just as the wind started carrying the smell of rot along with the symphony of horrible moans. April 14th, 23:57 hours. We experienced a blackout here for approximately 2 hours. The battery backups kicked in, providing some red battle lighting inside the complex. I suppose the power grid may finally be failing in this area. No way to determine. Power came back at 23:30. I am sure the system is automated, as I doubt any faithful electrical plant worker would be manning his, her post in times like these. April 15th, 19:20 hours. I am going out tonight to recon the area with the NVGs. I will be avoiding the high undead population area of the front blast door. That area is a quarter of a mile away over a small hill. John will be watching with the remote cameras. I told him that if there is any sign of trouble, I would lead them away from the complex and not to worry. It is not like they can see in the dark anyway. Perhaps I am becoming complacent, and I am underestimating them. I know that in large numbers, they are lethal. On that matter, they are lethal in numbers of one. Today I heard this strange mechanical sound 4 times. On one occasion, I rushed to the environmental control room to see if that was the source. It wasn't. The sound is coming from somewhere in the bowels of this complex. It may be some sort of pump or backup system. I cannot be sure. This is the first year I have ever been late on my taxes. April 16th, 14:09 hours. I patrolled the area last night. Before going out, I checked out the satellite photos in detail from the day before with John. The area is surrounded by 2 fences, and the main entrance is only accessible through an underground tunnel, or by walking up to it from outside the second fence. I also noticed that on the photos, there appeared to be a small group of bodies on the ground at the northeast side of the complex. I went up the stairs to the exterior access. I asked John to shut off the lights in my area to allow them to adjust to the dark before I went out. I waited 20 minutes for full night vision adjustment. I slipped on the NVGs, tightened the straps, and opened up the hatch. The cool night air smelled of spring honeysuckles. I stepped through the threshold into their world. After dogging the hatch behind me, I took the blanket from my shoulder and flung it over the fence in the same spot we originally climbed over. I had the codes to the gate, but I didn't want to have to work the cipher lock during an adrenaline rush. The blanket was a safer means of traversing the fence in this situation, By now, the blanket had been cut up in many places and wouldn't be good for anything but a fire after a couple more uses. I left it slung over the razor wire as my boots hit the ground and I started walking counterclockwise around the perimeter. I could see the eyes of numerous nocturnal animals in the area when I switched on the infrared on the NVGs. Rabbits and mice and squirrels were thick in this area at night. This is something to keep in mind for future food possibilities. I rounded the first corner of the fence and walked. As I left the area I was familiar with, I stepped into part of the complex I had seen. There was a 300-yard gap between our fence and the other fence I had never been to. Right where I stood, I estimated that John was 80 feet below. I could see the bright lights of the security cameras at the corner of our fence as they followed me. They also used infrared, so they were like beacons to my goggles. I approached the fence number 2 after almost a minute of jogging. I edged up toward the northeast corner. The moans and the smell of the dead strengthened as I approached. I was now out of range of most of the facility cameras, sans the main access door. I could now see the bodies piled up outside fence number 2, and faintly in the distance, I could also see the main mass of the dead relentlessly pounding on the main access door. I crouched down and quietly approached the corpses. The nearer I got, the more it made sense. The fence had numerous breaks in it from what I assume was automatic weapons fire aimed from the inside out. The corpses on the ground fell victim to someone inside the fence firing through at them. The bodies on the ground had been there for a long time. Maggots and other insects covered their bare skin. I scanned the interior of fence number 2 for the gunman that was responsible. I could see nothing inside the fence but tall grass. This fence must enclose something important, but I could not see any large steel hatches similar to the first fence we found. I couldn't help thinking that whoever shot these ghouls retreated back into the darkness of the bunker for safety. We have explored the facility and found nothing else inside it, living or dead. My mind wandered to the intermittent mechanical sound. I checked the fence where the damage was present and found that, though it was damaged, nothing bigger than a human arm could fit through it. There were dried bloodstains and chunks of skin on the jagged edges of the damaged wire, indicating that some of them were in fact putting their arms through it, attempting to reach their executioner. Quietly, I turned around and made my way back the way I came. Instead of going straight to fence number 1, I crossed over between the two fences, taking a different route. I came out between the fences on the west side of the complex. Again, I took notice of the long, level, grassy strip. I noticed it when we first found this area. I could easily take off or land a small aircraft here. It wouldn't be a bad idea to try and find one, just in case. After all, flying is not like riding a bike. It is a perishable skill. I jumped the fence, retrieved the blanket, entered the complex, and commenced to tell the others what I saw. April 19th, 12:11 hours. I returned last night from a 3-day trip to scavenge for supplies and needed equipment. I am injured and, once again, nearly did not survive this outing. John fared somewhat better than I did, with only a scratched face. One of them, in all its flailing, scraped him. We were on foot most of the time. Using the atlas and the air navigation chart I had from before, we were able to determine the location to the nearest airfield. According to our chart, a small private airstrip called Eagle Lake existed 20 miles north-northeast from Hotel 23. The night prior to our departure, John and I were able to pull up a satellite photo of the general area and, sure enough, 2 parallel concrete runways could be seen on the satellite visuals. A hangar and what appeared to be 2 small aircraft were parked near the small tower. As we zoomed out, the faint thread of I-10 could also be seen roughly 8 miles north of the airfield. We knew transportation might be necessary to return safely, so we zoomed in on the strip of I-10 directly north of the airfield. Cars were haphazardly stopped all over the interstate. This was the main vein that ran between the ruins of San Antonio and the city of Houston. There were droves of undead on the interstate. John and I thought it highly unlikely that going to the interstate would be fruitful in any way. The cool morning air of April rushed into the hatch as we turned the locking crank. The flowers were blooming, and it looked like a beautiful day. John and I were loaded down with equipment. He entered the cipher lock code that unlocked the gate, linking us once again to a world where we were not welcome. Sticking to the grassy and wooded areas, we made our way. As we neared the main entrance for the first time, we were able to see our door greeters in person, without the help of digital enhancement. John and I took turns with the binoculars as we watched from the distant bushes. Two words could probably sum them up: hungry, angry. I doubt anyone could fathom where their undying grudge toward the living originated. I didn't care to know either way. I was repulsed as they clawed and pounded on the heavy steel blast doors, breaking fingernails and leaving a brown liquid behind with each scratch and thud. Some of them were clearly agitated and were shoving others out of the way so they too could get a chance at turning their arms into stumps. Another startling fact worthy of mention was that one of them was using a rock as a bludgeon on the steel door. The rock was the size of a baseball, and the creature steadily and unrelentingly pounded away. I knew why we had never heard it before. The exterior blast door was just one of three doors that separated the outside world from our group inside Hotel 23. These creatures clearly retained some sort of primal sense about them. John and I continued our northerly track toward Eagle Lake. Prior to leaving Hotel 23, we attempted to print out the satellite photo to bring with us as a visual reference. For some reason, the security feature inside the control console would not allow printing operations that accessed the image intelligence, IMINT, folders. We were forced to draw notes and sketches on our existing atlas depicting landmarks of interest. After contemplating the bludgeoning corpse for a few minutes, we continued our journey northward toward Eagle Lake. The terrain was rough and unforgiving as we dredged our way through, intermittently cutting our legs on nature's barbed wire. After an hour of hiking, careful to remain just out of sight of the two-lane road, we came upon a group of crosses erected in the center of a field. There were four crosses of varying height. There were three undead corpses bound to the crosses, as the fourth was dead. It appeared that the local avian life had picked a majority of the corpse's brain right out of its head. Eerily, the other corpses locked onto us simultaneously as we approached. Their snarling heads swiveled laboriously as they struggled to hold them up and follow our movements. One of them was not restrained as well as the other two, and its legs flailed wildly in an attempt to free itself from the prison of crossed timber and restraints. John and I knew that if we shot them, it would without doubt bring more to our position. The crosses swayed in their makeshift holes as the dead struggled for freedom. We decided to leave the area and continue north. As we left this cursed field, I wondered what treacherous group of miscreants bothered to take the time and make the crosses, post them, and then crucify four dead on the cross. My mind then stumbled upon a very disturbing thought. What if they weren't dead when they were crucified? I didn't reveal this to John, as there was no point at us both being terrified of nothing. As we approached the boundaries of the field, we climbed the barbed wire fence and headed out into the open plains of Texas. I don't know if it was the prospect of flying again that forced me out here among them, or if it was just the need to see what was happening. I knew what was going on well enough. We were fucked, and there was nothing that could be said or done about it. Even a large spider is no match for an army of ants. We headed toward the hangar for the simple reason that we needed some specific supplies, i.e. hacksaw for the weapons locker, and because having an aircraft at Hotel 23 would be a very good escape vehicle. Another reason was that if we managed to clear out the undead in front of the blast doors, it would also be a good means by which to scout. I thought back to the satellite photos of the airfield. Of course, they were taken from a straight-down angle due to the fact that the camera was in space. I was decent at recognizing aircraft silhouettes. However, just being able to see the top-view wing profile, I was not sure if I was looking at two Cessna 172s or 152s. It didn't matter. The thought of being able to fly again gave me a positive feeling. John and I continued our journey to Eagle Lake Airfield. It was 1900 hours when we first smelled the aroma. It wasn't the rotting dead smell. It was the familiar smell of lake water being brought from the northern afternoon breeze. As we topped the next hill, a great watery expanse appeared before us. According to the Atlas, Eagle Lake was not a very big body of water. It seemed to welcome us, although, after my experience on the docks, God only knew what was lurking in its dark depths. We were near the airfield, but John and I knew we needed to find a place to sleep before it got dark. There was a road on the other side of the lake. I took out my binoculars, and I saw a large steel Greyhound bus was pulled over on the side of the road, along with several other smaller cars. I studied the bus for several minutes, making damn sure there was no movement, in or around it. I handed the binoculars to John, and he did the same. We carefully edged our way around the shorter side of the lake that led to the road. The sun was getting dangerously low as we neared the two-lane highway. There were numerous cars strewn about, but no undead movement. I knew they were out there. I just couldn't see them. John and I held our weapons ready as we edged toward the Greyhound. No chances. I knelt down on my knee, weapon pointed outward, and whispered to John to stand on my shoulder and look inside the bus to make sure. After repeating this in 6-foot intervals all the way to the back of the bus, we were satisfied it was empty. We were edgy. I wasn't particularly looking forward to seeing another one of these rotting fuckers, but I knew it was going to happen sometime on this trip. I walked over to the door of the bus and easily pulled it open. The locking bar wasn't set at the driver's seat, and the keys were still in it. I highly doubt the battery still worked, but I didn't care. This was just our hotel for the night. I stepped onto the bus, still careful. John followed. We shut the heavy steel glass door and pushed the locking bar in, making it impossible to open the door from the outside. The hair stood up on the back of my neck as my eyes caught a glimpse of something in the aisle on the back row. A human arm was lying across the walkway. It appeared in the advanced stages of decomposition. John stayed back, making sure to keep an eye on the perimeter of the bus as I checked it out. Weapon trained, I approached the rear of the bus. At 2/3 the length of the bus, I saw that the arm was just that, only an arm. I put on my Nomex gloves and quietly opened a window and tossed the fleshy, bony piece of shit out. It appeared that someone had wiped their ass all over the back seat, but it was only dried brown blood. I gave John the thumbs up, and we proceeded to quietly set up camp in here, after I checked under every single seat twice. I had 2 sets of AA batteries for the NVGs, but I was rationing them, and only using NVGs when absolutely necessary, so that night was spent in darkness, sans the moonlight. John and I whispered to each other, talking most of the night about how we were going to handle the next day. The airfield was not marked on the road atlas. We were going to have to extrapolate the location of the airfield by the air navigation chart that I still had. The atlas and the air chart were in 2 totally different scales, so we knew it would take some time to find it exactly. That night, I went to sleep to the sound of rain on the steel roof. It wasn't until 0300 hours when I was startled awake by lightning flash and thunder. I wiped my eyes and regained consciousness as I peered out the semi-tinted windows of the bus. The lightning was becoming frequent, and I was glad that we were inside. Then another flash, and I could see the outline of a human roughly 20 meters away. This was one of those necessary times, so I donned the NVGs. It wasn't human. It was the lone corpse of a drifter that still wore a pack on his back. I could see his cheekbones jutting through his leathery skin as the thing shifted its weight back and forth. The backpack seemed to be the type that not only fastened over the shoulders, but also with a chest strap to keep it steady while he walked. The creature's teeth were showing in an eternal grin as the water dripped from its lifeless body. It couldn't see us. John was still asleep. I didn't bother to disturb him. It wasn't long before the drifter moved on, into the darkness of the Texas night, to the next stop. The next morning, the 17th, we quietly packed our things and started to head out. On the way out the door, I asked John to cover me as I tried to turn over the bus engine out of sheer curiosity. True, it would make noise, but I just wanted to know if the battery still worked after all these months. I turned the key and held the starter switch. The bus made not one sound. It was dead like last night's drifter. John and I left the scene in search of the airfield. After a couple of hours of searching, we found the runways. It wasn't that far off the main road. It looked exactly like the satellite photographs portrayed it, so I was nearly certain we had the right field. In the distance, I could make out the shape of two aircraft parked near the tower. Cautiously, we approached the airfield perimeter fence, making sure to stop and listen at regular intervals. This fence was not topped with razor wire. John and I easily climbed it and set foot inside. We could see for hundreds of yards. There was no movement anywhere. We felt confident about our safety for the time being. This area seemed to be nearly devoid of all undead activity. I knew that I-10 was a few miles north of our position, and the satellite photos indicated a large undead population there. Perhaps they drew each other to I-10 in a similar way that water drops seemed to attract one another. It might have been the noise they were all making. It could have been my imagination, but every now and then, I thought I could hear the wind carry their familiar macabre sound from far into the distance. My main concern were the two aircraft, and if they were flyable. We edged closer and closer to the tower, eyes trained on the two birds, both parked close together. One of them was definitely a 172. The other was a 152, the slightly less powerful Cessna. I was no expert on how to repair them, but they seemed to look in decent shape from where we stood. Once again, I pulled out the binoculars to examine the perimeter from our vantage point. The hangars were closed, and I heard no commotion from that direction. The tower's tinted windows were very intimidating, as I could not tell whether or not one of those things was frothing at the mouth at us from up there. It had to be done, though, as we knew we were going to spend the night of the 17th inside the tower for protection. Once again, John and I stepped up to the tower doors. John covered me as I carefully turned the steel handle opening the door. It was dark inside. I switched on the flashlight on my weapon and began clearing the stairwell. No sign of blood, no sign of struggle. The tower was abandoned. As we neared the top of the tower, the feeling of dread soon left us. It was empty. Being inside the control tower brought back memories of our escape. That seemed like years ago. There was no power inside the tower, although I could see that an exterior light was on at the hangar. Must have been a tripped breaker. I never bothered to find out. Our next order of business was to check the hangars, as more than likely the tools and materials we were after were inside. It was approaching 1400 hours, and it was exceptionally hot that day. With complacency set in heavy, John and I lackadaisically approached the first hangar. I signaled to John to cover me, and I slung the door open. It was then our lazy attitude almost killed us. A rotted corpse in a white apron and undershirt came barreling out of the doorway with hedge-trimming shears clamped in its left hand. It had no idea it was using them as a weapon as it charged John, seemingly oblivious to my presence. The thing stumbled quickly and fell onto John, gnashing its rotting teeth. The cutting shears cut John's cheek, causing him to cry out in pain. I could hear the sound of some other movement inside the hangar. I kicked the creature off of John and spun around to the open doorway that was devoid of light. I thought John was fine, but apparently the fall had knocked him out. The thing that I had kicked off John now had a new target in mind. Me. Again, it charged in a slow tumble toward me. It was too late. By the time I reacted to the familiar gurgling sound it made, it had already inadvertently stabbed me in the ribs with the trimming shears. I spun around in red-hot anger. After kicking the thing in the chest, knocking it to the ground very near John, I trained my sights between the eyes and neutralized it. The brains looked like blue cauliflower right before the dust adhered to the sticky mess. The shears were still in the creature's hand. I assume they had been there for months, and now will be forever. I knelt down near John and slapped him in the face a few times. His blood was all over my hands. Although my wound was worse than his, he seemed to be bleeding more. I checked the shears. They seemed dry, other than our fresh blood. A sound reminded me of the other danger we could be facing. I wasn't going to leave John knocked out. I kept slapping him until he finally woke up. I helped him to his feet and told him to keep a lookout. The light I had seen previously on the hangar was above the open door. Two large hangar doors were on both sides of the open doorway. I planned to enter the hangar and hit the door switch, bathing the inside with sunlight. As I entered the doorway, I caught a glimpse of one of them. I had no choice but to take it out. My muzzle flash revealed more of them. The flash was bright, and it temporarily burned the image of six other corpses into the back of my retina. I reached over for the switch and hit it. No joy. I tried the one below it and heard the rumble of the garage door sound. I made for the door with my back to John, pointing the weapon ahead of me into the dying darkness of the hangar. Looking over my shoulder, I could see that John was very lightheaded and leaning on his rifle. I yelled at him to get back with me. It was game time. I readied my rifle and waited for them to come. The first one made the roll call. I killed her with one shot. More soon followed, excited by their first sight of food in months. With outstretched arms, they gave chase. John was trying to shoot, but missed every shot. I finished most of them in one shot, however, two of them I missed twice. The last creature fell 4 feet from where I stood. There were 8 expired undead at the bay doors and on the dirt in front of the hangar. I had killed them all. I checked my magazine and reloaded. John was regaining his composure, and the bleeding on his cheek had stopped. He nodded to me that he was okay, and that we needed to get these bodies out of sight, because the dead were not the only ones that could have heard those gunshots. We both knew what the other was thinking. The crosses. We dragged the bodies inside a corner of the hangar, cutting shears and all. After looking around for a few minutes, we found a blue tarp to disguise their demonic presence. I forgot about my wound until John stumbled across a first aid kit mounted next to a fire extinguisher. Using my knife to break the seal, I commenced to taking out what I needed. I took out the iodine, the medical tape, and the gauze. I unzipped my flight suit and pulled it to my waist. I could see the dark blood clearly through my dark green undershirt. I was afraid to pull up my shirt. Slowly, I slid the shirt up over my left ribcage, and saw that it wasn't that bad, but it definitely needed first aid. I shook the iodine, opened it, and then liberally applied it to the wound. It was cold and stung a little. It didn't need stitches. The iodine turned my skin bright orange. I applied the gauze and tightly wound the tape around my ribcage until I was satisfied. Checking the fence, John and I noticed that in the distance gathered a group of 3 undead. They were drawn to the sound of the gunfire. They were too far away to see us, but it was still an uneasy feeling, knowing they were there and reacting to our audible presence. After finding numerous supplies, i.e. hacksaw, wrenches, fuel siphon, spray lubricant, and an old leather bomber jacket, we proceeded to look through the publications room of the hangar. Inside, we found numerous Cessna checklists, some of them outdated, but they would work in this situation. Also of importance was a maintenance manual covering the Cessna 172 and the 152. John and I took our bounty and headed toward the aircraft. Now there were 4 at the fence. We were at the aircraft, and I immediately began to run the aircraft checklist to see if it was even operational. It took me a few minutes to accomplish, however. After 3 attempts at engine start, the prop finally turned over and it sputtered to life. I got all the systems running and checked the fuel. I was sitting at half capacity, or 2 hours of airtime. I calculated that Hotel 23 was only about a 20-minute flight, so fuel wasn't the issue. The undead quickly growing in numbers outside of the fence was. I shut down the engine, and John and I proceeded back to the hangar to get a fuel can so that we could siphon fuel from the 152 to the 172. There were now 10 at the fence. They were not trying to get in, but they were milling about, drawn to the noise of gunshots and aircraft engines. John and I grabbed the can and proceeded to accomplish the tedious task of siphoning 22 gallons of fuel to top off the aircraft. After 20 gallons, the 152 was bone dry. Oh well. Doing quick math in my head, I knew we had roughly 3 hours and 45 minutes of airtime before she glided out of the sky. We loaded up the back seat of the aircraft with our equipment. We also stuffed every nook and cranny of the avionics bay with everything we could fit. I also took some oil for the aircraft from the maintenance hangar, as you just never know. As a final preparation, I took the battery out of the 152 and squeezed it into the pile of supplies in the back seat. We were running heavy, but I had experience with that, and this time we had a real runway, not a dirt track. It was getting late. There were only 13 of them at the fence, so I doubted that they would breach it. As we performed our final preparation on the aircraft, we heard faint automatic weapons fire in the distance. Upon hearing the sound, many of the creatures gave up at the fence and wandered off toward the new sound. Who was it? John and I had no idea. Worst case, and it probably was worst case, it was the crazy fuckers that crucified those poor bastards in that field a few miles north of Hotel 23. John and I prepped everything we could and retired to the control tower for a restless night of sleep. I woke up the next morning to a shooting pain in my ribs. John's face looked much better, but my cut was getting infected. I cleaned it again and applied clean dressing. It was 1,000 hours that morning before I felt like leaving the tower. There was no sign of undead at the fence now, and John and I did not hear any gunfire the night before. Now came the obvious problem. How the hell were we going to fly the plane back, land at the grass strip next to H-23, get out of the aircraft, and then climb the fence without getting eaten? John and I thought on this for a few hours and narrowed down a night approach with night vision goggles as our best option. I expressed my concern that the loud noise of the engine would draw them to our position regardless of night or day. It was then that John asked, "Well, can you land it with the engine off?" I laughed at him and told him that I didn't know and that I had never tried to land an aircraft with the engine cut except during flight training under controlled situations. I thought on this for a good while before agreeing that it might work. John and I patiently waited for the night to come. It wasn't until 20:50 hours on the 18th of April that we decided it was time to go home. That night, as we loaded up our bedrolls and random gear from the tower into the aircraft, we heard gunfire again. This time, the weapons fire was closer, much closer. John and I could also hear something that sounded like vehicle engines between the gun bursts. We hopped in, locked our harnesses, and proceeded to get our asses home. I knew that we could easily be able to find H-23 because of the security cameras. Using the NVGs, I was able to see anything that shined in the infrared wavelength, just like it were a beacon. We instructed William to make sure the cameras were on and infrared capable before they retired to bed each night. This was our failsafe, our breadcrumb trail that would lead us home. I taxied her to the runway, careful to skip the step that turns the landing lights on. No strobes, no lights, nothing to give away our position. As I centered her nose wheel on the center line of the runway, I could see grainy green images of numerous human figures on the other side of the fence. Neither John nor I wanted to find out if they were friend or foe. I released the brakes, and at 50 knots indicated airspeed. I pulled her nose up, and we were once again airborne. Using the air navigation chart, I began to point the nose of the aircraft in the direction of H-23. As we cleared the end of the runway, I could see automatic muzzle flash on the ground below. I had no idea if they were shooting at me, or if they were defending themselves. Thinking back to the crosses, I leaned toward the former. It wasn't long until I could see the glow of the numerous security cameras in my NVGs. I made one circling pass to get my bearings, and then climbed to 2,500 feet and began my circling approach. At 2,500 feet, I reluctantly cut my engine and knew we were going to be on the ground whether we liked it or not. I didn't know how to air start this plane. This was a one-way ticket back to sea level. My right wing was parallel with the western fence, two western corner cameras. I kept checking my altimeter and airspeed. 80 knots, 1,500 feet. I circled again, this time with a steeper angle of bank because I was too high. I bled off some altitude and came around on final approach at 600 feet. We were definitely falling faster than I was comfortable with. I could see H-23 off my left wing. The NVGs were shit for depth perception, so I had to keep my eye on my altimeter. I set it to sea level before I took off. 300, 200, 100, 70 knots. At 10 feet, I flared the aircraft back to soften the landing. The prop was still windmill.